From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
The meddling began right after the Russian Revolution when Woodrow Wilson sent American troops to fight in the Russian Civil War against the Communists.
That was NYU professor Stephen Cohen, an internationally known expert in Russian affairs. As he appeared recently on CNN, he was being interrupted by Max Boot from the Council on Foreign Relations. Cohen was pointing to the meddling done by the U.S. in Russian internal affairs after the October 1917 revolution. That meddling took the form of a military invasion by the United States. It was at that point that Russia decided to strike back.
The meddling began on the Soviet and Russian side when the Communists formed the Communist International, 1919. Ever since then, Moscow's meddled in our politics, we have meddled in theirs. This is low-level stuff, what went on. It is not an attack. It is not 9/11. It is not Pearl Harbor. It is not Russian paratroopers descending on Washington. This kind of hyperbole, an attack on America, suggests we need to attack Russia. I think that Mr. Boot would have been happy if Trump had waterboarded Putin at the summit and made him confess. Trump carried out an act of diplomacy fully consistent with the history of American presidencies. Let us see what comes of it, then judge.
For more on that, we spoke with our regular contributor, Professor Luciana Bone, who's been schooling us in the history of the Soviet Union and its relations with the West. So that was Professor Stephen Cohen. He is one of the voices of sanity, one of the preeminent voices of sanity that they allow into the media in the United States. You know, part of the atmosphere that's being sucked into the political discussion over what happened in Helsinki 2 weeks, 3 weeks ago now, whatever, a couple weeks ago, where President Trump and President Putin sat down behind closed doors for an hour and a half to 2 hours to talk about, you know, some of the things that are driving the apparent movement towards war. I mean, we've had since 1991 a movement of U.S. and NATO troops from the former border with the former Warsaw Pact, cutting through Germany and, you know, going down the middle of Europe, right up to Russia's borders, where you've had abrogation of treaties that kept the peace, like anti-ballistic missile treaties, so nobody felt like, hey, if they shoot at us, we can shoot back. That's not threatened. All these things got swept aside from 1991 until the end of the Obama administration, and suddenly there's a discussion about let's pull back from the brink, and these people are going crazy. And that's,
yep,
that what we just heard is like one of the few voices of sanity who gets ridiculed by the likes of Max Boot, and if it's possible to find some, lessers.
Yeah, well, so what does Max Boot, Anderson Cooper, CNN, Hillary Clinton, the Council on Foreign Relations, which is a liberal, non-governmental think tank, then we have the American Enterprise, well, exactly what are they so upset about? The whole liberal conservative spectrum, you could say that really there is no more Republican or Democratic Party in the United States. You just have the neoliberal, neocon party, one party. They're sort of spread in between. But I think I talk about that. I follow my outline.
Right.
So what is it that the whole media, the whole think tank culture, shall we call it, the state officials, they're all upset at Trump? In this case, over the meeting at Helsinki, because he apparently didn't waterboard Putin.
Right. He should have walked into the room, you know, grabbed them, put him in a chokehold, maybe waterboarded him or whatever. Not to mention, by the way, all the folks that want to do that, none of them volunteered.
No.
I mean, Trump is in his 70s, so he wouldn't be the guy to do that himself personally. You know, Anderson Cooper, that's not exactly the field he plays on. And, you know, there's a whole lot of others like Max Boot and others that haven't seen many examples of them out there toughen it up, you know, to conduct this kind of an aggressive meeting with someone. And so I guess they wanted somebody to bust into the meeting, you know, hold down Putin and, you know, and do this to him, waterboard him or whatever. Yeah. But there were no volunteers.
Yeah. So there are two questions here. Let's call it the establishment, the liberal establishment. Really, the correct term is the neocon, neoliberal establishment.
Right.
The one that wanted Hillary Clinton elected. Why are they upset at Trump? And why are they promoting Cold War II on Russia?
Right.
Well, some of the answers are simple. Right. Why do they want a Cold War II on Russia? Because Russia refuses to become a vassal of Washington.
Right.
Sovereignty is Putin's most frequently used word.
Yep.
In the context of foreign relations discussion. And if Russia were not a nuclear power, it would have shared the fate of Iraq,
right,
of Syria, of Libya, of Yugoslavia.
Yep.
It would have been invaded, bombed, and ruined. Unfortunately, the father of all terror, Stalin, took care of that. They developed a hydrogen bomb.
Yep.
This is driving them crazy. They cannot bring Russia to heel. Lavrov said, everybody, you know, in his laid-back, super ironic tone, they all want us to repent. The sports people want us to repent. We are the ones to repent.
Yes.
And then, you know, they will consider slowly to admit us, to remove the threat or the sanctions or something like that.
Right.
So that is what upsets the established order. The order that has been in place called the New World Order, as soon as the Soviet Union disintegrated, really was pushed in 1992, starting in the 80s, right? One minute here. I'm getting technical difficulties. Okay. So there were two. Now, Stephen Cohen was intimate with Gorbachev, not in any.
Right, we get it. Yeah.
Yeah, scholarly. Stephen Cohen had written a biography of Bukharin, which Gorbachev greatly appreciated. Gorbachev studied Western culture at university, which I find hilarious. But anyway, that is Stephen Cohen and his wife, Katrina van der Heuvel, who's, of course, associated editor of The Nation.
Nation magazine, yep.
Yeah, they traveled to Russia all the time, and both Gorbachev and this couple and many others were really social democrats, and they were interested in this reform in Russia. So when the Soviet Union dissolved, the U.S. and Russia had different expectations. This is what the United States, not the people like Stephen Cohen, Katrina van der Heuvel, but the establishment. And remember, these were the Bush senior years. So what we had was triumphalism. U.S. said, now we are the only superpower in the world. The U.S. considered the end of the Soviet Union the end of history. That is the end of all ideology. Because, of course, capitalism is natural. It was there since the Stone Age, according to this. So 90% of the Congress then supported this fairy tale. And it was being theorized that the United States would planned that the United States would extend its dominion throughout the globe, that it would be impossible for systems other than American liberal capitalist systems and cultures to survive. And so the United States was convinced of the universality of its values. Well, in general, this has been the ideology, the philosophy of liberalism since the birth of capitalism.
That's correct.
So it was convinced of the universality of its values and convinced, too, of its mission of exporting democracy, American-style democracy, to the world. They would have no opposition. All these little people would just accept American rule. Let's call it that.
Yep.
Now, yes?
No. I was just agreeing. Backfill this a little bit. We found out a few years back. Once the Soviet Union was over, supposedly all kinds of documents were found and they were leaked and stuff. And a lot of it was psyop warfare then. Oh, yeah, we found proof that all the lies we were telling about Soviet Union before were actually true. And here Stalin signed this thing saying he likes to eat dead babies and stuff like that. And we heard all that. But on the other hand, also documents were released that showed the actual plans and counterplans. And one of the plans that was exposed in the last few years, go back to September of 1945 in a memo to Major General Leslie Groves in the U.S. military.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Who was a commander in charge of the development of the nuclear bombs at the Manhattan Project. Mm-hmm. And in essence, there's details to it, but once they were able to build 466 warheads, which was the number that they decided they needed, to take out 66 Soviet cities, they were ready to go to nuclear war to destroy the Soviet Union. And they started building them. And the only thing that it was budgeted for, the forces were being developed around it. Oh, well, we'll need this many fighters, and we need this many boats to bring this here, and we need railroad to do that, and we need this many frozen hamburgers to send to the troops. All that stuff was developed. And the only thing that stopped it was the fact that the Soviets blew off their own nuclear weapon before they built the 466 bombs, and then suddenly, they can fight back, never mind. So that is sort of the backdrop to what you're talking about. It isn't like, we were irrationally afraid of them and they were irrationally afraid of us. The U.S. was coming for the Soviet Union, and all of this stuff happens against that backdrop. And I just wanted to make sure people are clear on that.
Yes, between 45 and 49,
yep.
The debate was serious between the Pentagon and the Council on Foreign Relations, which is really a branch of the State Department, on what they should do. And the Chiefs of Staff did present this 66, you say, I said 60 in one of my articles.
Yeah.
I think it was a 30-day campaign.
Yep.
Of bombing 60 cities with 60 nuclear bombs, something like that.
Yeah.
But the problem was then invading, mopping up.
Right, the mopping up is a problem, right.
Mopping up the radioactive territory. And for that, they had lined up the Ukrainian Nazi collaborator forces.
Right.
All the same, in 47 or so, between 46 and 47, George Kennan at the State Department, who had been ambassador to Russia and was a Russian expert, proposed instead the containment.
That strategy.
The containment theory.
Yep.
But it was really the rollback of world communism. So they weren't just interested. Taking out the Soviet Union was one thing, but how would you take out the world communist movement in Vietnam, in all over Africa, Latin America, and Asia, and Europe?
Right.
That was the problem, you see. You could not eliminate communism by just taking out the Soviet Union. So but there were these two proposals.
Yep.
So If that isn't interference in the existence of a country, well, I don't know what is.
And there's another aspect to this, too, by the way, which I just to interrupt very briefly on this point. If you look at the intent, if you look at the basis of the revolution in the Soviet Union, in Russia, that became, the Bolshevik Revolution that brought forth the Soviet Union, ultimately the People's Republic of China, and everything that followed, it is not merely national development, although it is certainly that, that you're looking at. The Russian Revolution can be looked at and contained even its own bourgeois revolution, like those that took place in Europe and parts of Asia that were advanced economically. There's a class character to this, and particularly a self-aware class character and a declared class character and a policy-driven class character to this that was identified certainly not only by those making the declarations, hi, this is a workers' and peasants' revolution, and we are now allies with the workers and peasants around the world, but by those who were oppressing workers and peasants around the world. They saw this in its class context before anyone else, and that was the great threat. And that was what drove the policy. Yeah. That's right.
The threat was not only in Europe to the capitalist class, but the threat was also in the colonies, in the European colonies throughout the world, where there was an anti-colonial movement, an anti-colonial sentiment. So the Bolshevik Revolution did not just threaten the persistence of capitalism in Europe, but also the existence of imperialism, of European Western imperialism throughout the world. And in fact, the first directives proclamations of the revolutionary government in November 1917 was one declaring the number one was pulling out of the war. Number two, I can't remember the other two. Number two was extending independence or the second one was liberating what they call the national peoples within, which we would call the ethnic people, within the Tsar's empire.
Right, this is the Russian empire. You had a Russian empire that was ethnic Russians that dominated this empire, and what they were talking about doing was they were looking at it as an empire and saying, no, we don't do this anymore.
Yeah, you have equal status with us.
Right.
You who had no political rights before, you have equal status with us, with the revolutionary government, which became the Soviet Union, or you can decline to join. They gave them a choice. They would accept them unequal political rights, but also they grant them the right to separate, to stay out, which, of course, unfortunately, when it was all over in the 90s, the United States used to break up this fraternity that had been built.
Yep.
So, yeah, the Bolshevik Revolution and Eastern, what I call Eastern Marxism, was anti-capitalist, if we want to put it in a negative sense, and anti-imperialist from the start.
That's right.
I mean, anti-imperialism threatened the
imperialists.
Yeah.
I mean, you had okay. One of the, you have these two decrees from the Congress in Petrograd. One which was which came from Lenin, that you mentioned. Another brought all lands and buildings into public ownership in Russia.
Yeah. That's right. The distribution of land. First one was pull out of the war. Second one was distribution of land. Third one was it the colonial, the liberation of the colonial?
The nationalities question, that's correct, yep.
Yeah. And the fourth, you remember?
The decree, the promises of the revolution were peace, land, and bread. And so what they ended up also was anti-colonialism thrown in there. So there were four, but the third was essentially bread. It was that, you know, we are with the peasants, and we are going to provide for them, and they're going to provide for us because we're together.
Yep. So we were talking before we went into...
A
very useful digression. We were talking about how the United States saw the opportunity that the breakup of the Soviet Union, dissolution of the Soviet Union, offered. They saw it as a chance to impose capitalist ideology, neoliberal economics on the world. Now, Russia had a different interpretation, as you might imagine.
Yeah, no kidding, yeah.
For Russia, this was not a defeat. It was an autonomous decision, from their point of view, to end communism and begin a new phase. They were crazy, but let that go. Though weakened economically and militarily, there was in Russia, the Russia of the new federation, a desire to recover its prestige and to reconstruct its image in the search of a new identity within this dissolved world, and to dialogue on equal terms with the United States and the other Western powers. This was not what the United States, what the establishment then and now intended. What kind of Russia would Washington like? Okay. So as the bipartisan hysteria over Helsinki showed, we have in the United States no longer a Democratic and a Republican party. We have the party of neocon and neoliberal consensus, one party. The neoliberal concerned themselves with imposing economic servitude on the world, mainly through debt, which imposes rabid privatization and abolition of public services. So that's the neoliberal economic branch. Either you do, as we say, economically, or we come after you. That's why they went after Iraq.
That's right.
Why Saddam. That's why they went after Milosevic.
Yep.
That's why they went after Assad and after Gaddafi.
That's correct.
So if a country refuses neoliberal economics, the neocon fist sets in. They're warmongering. Both are warmongers, but they work together.
Or the Max Boot.
Yeah.
I mean, because again, one of the first ones, one of the first examples under the Obama administration actually was Cote d'Ivoire, where you had President Gbagbo, who had led a successful, call it a constitutional revolution inside the country, who now was looking at taking control of Cote d'Ivoire's currency, which was being printed in Paris, the former colonial power, 20, 30 years after supposed independence, saying, you know what, we're going to print our own currency. Suddenly, he's replaced by a guy that came from the IMF.
Yes, technocrat.
It just shows the point.
The bankocrat. So, yeah, I mean, if a country refuses neoliberal economics, you get sanctions, blockades, regime change, colored revolution, bombing, invasion,
and neoliberal economics at the end of all of that.
Yes,
right.
And what has happened in the world, all over Europe, and in the United States, is that people have said, "Enough, you perverts! Enough. We've had enough of your liberal order."
Yep.
And because it has come home. Poverty in the United States is huge, etc. But, you know, in this regard, you mentioned Cote d'Ivoire. And so this is the kind of... So I remember in the mid-90s speaking to the South African poet here at the university that I taught, Dennis Brutus. He had an appointment at Pittsburgh, University of Pittsburgh, and I invited him up here to speak, and the students loved him. Now, he had been in prison on Robben Island with Mandela and the other leaders of the ANC. So I asked him, so what do you think will happen now? This is about 1995. what do you think will happen now that the ANC is in power? And he answered very tersely and kind of sadly. He said, it's either the AMF or Cuba. Mm. That is, it's either the AMF or we become blockaded by Cuba. And so the ANC chose the IMF. Not many choices there. Cuba,
right.
Now it's 70 years. If it had not, it would have been worse than Cuba. It might have been Libya, South Africa.
Right.
So, you know, the kind of Russia that the neoliberal, neocon establishment, as I call them, Max Boot, as well as Hillary Clinton, liberals and conservatives, conservatives of the traditional type, because Trump is the wild card, the crazy horse in this mix, and that's why they don't want people to hear what he says. It doesn't matter that he may not accomplish it.
Right.
It doesn't matter that he's not abolishing NATO. People have heard him say that he, during the candidacy, that he would stop a regime change coups, that he would stop the wars. Well, the
right.
order doesn't want people to hear this. That's
right.
one of the reasons.
That's heresy. I mean, it's not even, it's not a discussion of whether or not this is policy, or a discussion of, by the way, whether or not this is good policy, but that is not even supposed to be discussed. It is
exactly.
part of the background. It's like the stars that move through the sky. It is just that which goes on in the universe. Regime change takes place as part of the natural order, and there is no, not only no purpose to raising it, but it's heresy to raise it as a, even as an observation.
And this is really what's at the bottom of swamping us with this ridiculous
right.
Max Boot, Anderson Cooper, Anne Applebaum, and all the flying monkeys of the empire.
That's right.
So, you know, what kind of Russia would they like? Well, they would like a Russia like what, you know, something a little better than Iraq. But anyway,
Jeffrey Sachs was pretty clear. Jeffrey Sachs discussed it at length. I'm looking at the moment. At a New York Times article from June 27th of 1993. So we're talking 25 years ago last month. And what they want, they basically, okay, General Pinochet was a tyrant, Sachs says, but he did represent the interests of the Chilean middle class and thus was a strong supporter of market reforms. In Russia, by contrast, an authoritarian government would undoubtedly serve as a front for the military-industrial complex, which Sachs believes is an obstacle to a rebirth. In other words, those that want to hand over the wealth of the country and murder those opposed to it are on the right team, and those who, regardless of the morality of it, I'm not even passing on that, who would stand with the forces that would defend the national economy against being, you know, ripped off, basically, that's bad. And Sachs talking that in 93, and he was one of the leading, you know, with Goldman Sachs, one of the leading policymakers from the United States that were not just advising, but more or less pulling the strings and whispering into the ear of the bartender of Boris Yeltsin.
Yeah, what they're furious at Putin about, is that he's not Yeltsin. So they want Yeltsin
right.
Russia. And let's see just what happened.
Well, we got to pick it up next week there because we're out of time. But you're exactly right. And we can start by studying what did happen. We have December of 1991. The Soviet Union is dissolved more or less by resignation, illegally, et cetera. And then all kinds of things happen to the socialist property of that country. We'll pick it up there. And thank you so much, Luciana. We appreciate
Very good.
It.
Thank you, Don.
Yep.
Pleasure to be with you.
The same.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.